never felt, I've never addressed myself to the public at Korach. I've never spoken about him. I did speak about many of our beautiful heroes. Abraham, Gabriel, Moshe, Aaron, Joseph. I have a series of verses about Chirat Yosef. However, I was not attracted by the figure of Kirach. Lately, just simply studying the Ramban, I realized that the Kirach story was not just a simple event. It was more than that. And actually, the Kirach story of the conference with Moses had a great relevance at our times. Many of the complaints we hear now is reference to us, but the tradition is much from there, according to it. It does not reflect, echo actually, I mean, the complaints by God. Now, tonight I want to address myself to this topic, particularly, I mean, to two arguments which Korach advanced against Moses, and I'm trying to analyze them in light of matter evidence, matter of philosophy. But I believe that, I mean, those arguments are very important as far as we are concerned. The Korach rebellion was a unique event. Prior to that event, the people complained, protested, murmured spontaneously, always in response to the physical need. They were confronted to me, both to biological pressure. They suffered from tortures, hunger, thirst, with the fear of an enemy, to see. Be it a Amalek, be it a serpent, and be it simply the wilderness itself. Because primitive man is afraid not only of living beings, but even of any phenomenon. Let me just read a few scriptures. Vayisu bnei Yisroel lefneihem, bnei Mitzrayim nisriach hareihem, vayiru meit v'yitzchakun. Children of Israel lifted their eyes, and they beheld the Egyptians marching after them. And they were so afraid, and the sons of Israel cried. Cried in sense, it's not in the colloquial, physical colloquial cry, it means they protested. When you insert Yitzchak, I don't mean your cry, to protest. Tzoka in Hebrew is basically protest. Since fear prompted their protest. Then we read in the Torah, Vayoreim Morosa, Vayoyochu Vishtus Mayim Morot, Kimorevein. Vayoreim Morosa, Vayoreim Morosa, Vayoreim Morosa, Vayoreim Morosa. And when they came to Mara, they could not range on the waters of Mara, but they were bigger, and the people murmured against Moses. Then, what prompted their protest? First. By the way, you come and ask me, Israel, our nation, our Aaron, the Negro, the Yimra, and the Israel, the Yitim, and the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses. When we sat by the fresh pasture, and when we did eat bread, a hungry person. An angry person. An angry person is not a silent person, but very loud. By Yisra Kol Adas Israel, Vayachan the Sidim, the Mayim Mishkes, by Yorev Rom Mimoshe, by Yimru, Mimon Mayim, and the Tavish and encamped in a city, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people did quarrel with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. There were no political disagreements with Moses or ideological controversies. There were no rebellions. There was just protest, complaint. and clothes, and all those protests, complaints and quarrels, who were consequences of discomfort and hardship, were subjected to first and second year of the security. We wanted to water and food. We were afraid to protest. Even the golden calf episode, that is of a given of love, was not precipitated by idolatrous ideas that corroded the moral fiber and influenced the philosophy of the people. No, not at all. The golden calf was precipitated by the primitive instinctual horror that befalls the lost sheep in the wilderness and in wild and open spaces. It was a spontaneous reaction to the primordial terror of the jungle. They were lost in the jungle. They thought Moses will never come back. And without Moses, what can they do? How can they survive in the jungle? It is the fear, the instinctual horror, I shouldn't even use the term here, the instinctual terror and horror which strikes the worship when the latter realizes that it has separated itself from the earth, from the flock. By Yikori Roma Lari, Kuma Seinon Ramadim, Tizeru Ish Moshe, Liyotanu Mechoyale. And the people assembled under Aaron and said, Allah, make us a God who shall go before us, because we lost Moses. In a word, all the previous thoughts were unorganized, unplanned. Reactions, unplanned, spontaneous reactions to situations that they could not be confronted. That they had to confront, and they did not know how to confront such situations. They were generated, basically, the previous forms, by a mocked mentality, which gets easily excited, but also can regain easily its equilibrium. The Korach controversy was of a totally different character. The rebellion was not due to ungratified physical desires, such as hunger and thirst. Not at all. Second, the drought was not involved at all. The nurses were not involved at all. The arm, the mob, which demanded from Aaron to make them a god, the arm, which protested in Rephidim, was thirsty to want water. The arm, which wanted to stone Moses and Aaron during the rabbi episode, was not involved at all. The mob did not participate in the anti-Moses campaign, as they call it. Only individuals, the leadership consisted of several individuals, the followers, a few hundred most, Hamishim Masani, much thereafter, all individuals, mostly of the intellectual elite, of the aristocracy, who were involved. The Torah tells us, you see, fully made, conscious show, princes of the congregation, called into the assembly, men of men. This was a rebellion, not just a quarrel, a rebellion. An organized movement, well planned and painstakingly prepared.
In short, when you may speak, should you use a colloquial legal term of a Korach conspiracy. There was no conspiracy as far as the episode of the miracle was concerned. No conspiracy. Everything was spontaneous, unorganized, unplanned. The immediate reaction to fear, to the story about the giants. But in Korach it was a conspiracy, premeditated and carefully set out. It was a real rebellion. Apparently, if we should trace, the history of that rebellion, what psychologically prompted it, what is the theology of that rebellion, I believe we should follow the Ramban. Ramban is excellent. Whatever I say here, about the background, you may find the Ramban if you study the Ramban carefully. Apparently, Korach's enmity was incurred by Moshe at the time of the elevation of Aaron to the high priesthood. Rashi was acknowledged. The high priesthood and the appointment of the Levites as mere servants in the sanctuary. It didn't like. However, this happened a year before. However, Korach, in spite of the fact that he was angry, and Moshe incurred his enmity, did not attempt to come out properly against Moshe, since he understood very well that the people, notwithstanding minor incidents, were devoted and loyal to their great leader, and that any attempt to unseat Moshe would be met with anger and derision. You wait patiently for an opportunity, for an event that will somehow undermine Moshe's position and his popularity. You waited for what again? He hated Moshe in just this hatred, and he was hoping that the opportune moment would arrive. And, as a matter of fact, the opportune moment did arrive sooner than Korach anticipated. The miracle incident. Perhaps this was the most tragic incident in Moshe's life. The miraculous incident episode and the suspect decreed by the Almighty that all adults die in the desert. It was a hard blow to Moses' prestige in the eyes of the crowd. For a while, a short while, he was degraded. He lost his income. Moses promised on behalf of the Almighty. His slaves in Egypt, before they left Egypt, while they were still busy building barracks and fortresses for Pharaoh, he promised those slaves that they will enter into the promised land. The men flowing honey. And they'll probably enter the land in a short time after the departure from Egypt. Indeed, when we read Palestine, they were ready to invade the Negev the second year after following the Exodus. As it is related to us in Numbers 10:29, Moshe, the chief of the ruler of the journey, Chesem Yeshem, Noisim Anachnu Al Amotim, Asher Omer Ad Yeshem, Eisei Eter Lachem, Lachol Itano. We are journeying to the place which the Eternal said, I shall give to you. Come down with us. What place was Meshach talking about? عن إسحاق. ما صحيح؟ فأنت أفراد من necessity. They wouldn't have entered. They wouldn't have entered at Israel. From the east, but from the left, from the south. Suddenly, like the lightning bolt, he appeared to his father. The stay in the wilderness, it was extended for 39 more years. Suddenly, all the hopes, all the dreams, but soon, we will invade the land flowing with the European army. This is kind of checkup. No land, no conquest, no leaders of the European army, no realization of the promised privacy. We were inside. It became a reality suddenly became a vision. Many, many bleak and dreary years will have to pass before the soil will set its foot on the soil of the promised land. Where is Moses pledge? We ask each other. And Terach life cannot be those questions. Those questions are not directed to the object.
Where is Moses?
People complained, but there was a complaint of hopelessness. Moses' popularity was at the low end. Now, Terach starts that. The time has arrived, and I may reveal my claims to other people against whom Moshe discriminated. And Terach started to recruit disgruntled and frustrated people and organize a formidable opposition to Moshe. More or less, the Rabban because when the Rebbe said that the incident of Korach happened immediately after the construction of the Mishkan, Rabbi said, no. It happened after the Meradli episode. And that the Ramban is right, and he was right wrong, we have proof, ample proof on the Pesukim. What did Gershon Rahiron tell Moshe when he sent for them, when he invited them to come over? Aflei aleret zobas holo vud vosha v'yisod v'atipel lonu nachlasod evetan. You didn't bring us into the land. I finally knew it. And you did not give us a share in that land. It means your promise did not come through. Interestingly, the word Vayikach. The word Vayikach was interpreted by Rashi in two ways. In one way, it's a very obscure word. I mean, the semantics of the word is very obscure. In one way, Rashi says, Lotach es atmei lezat echot. Li es nechlat mitecho eido. Le eire hala kohuna. Let me translate it in English, but it's not. I mean, the meaning is obscure. He betook himself. On one side, with the intention of you, of separating himself from the community, so that he may raise a protest regarding the priesthood. This is therefore an interpretation translation of Rashi. What Rashi means, Terach made finally, until Terach, no one dared to view Moshe's father. But people around there said, give us water, give us food. We remember this flesh back of Egypt. Here. Huh? We stood in awe before Moses. Here I go with the first one. Look at us. He dared, for the first time, leave snack flap in the place to separate himself from the community which was committed to Moshe, revered Moshe, loved him, despite that other thing, and was loyal to him. He was the first one. I believe that Lokah Hasatzne put himself in something else. He dedicated himself completely to that task. He took himself, he dedicated himself at this time. There was only one goal in Terah's life. One goal. He was ready to sacrifice his life in order to achieve that goal. Name with that. To unseat Moshe. To demote Moshe. He dedicated his whole self to this diabolical plan of undermining Moses' exalted position within the community. Vayikach means he committed himself totally to the implementation of that plan. However, it was an individual affair. It did not let him influence. He decided he hated Moses. He did not betray Hesed. He did not disclose that he liked him. At the beginning, he did not reveal anything to the prospective conspirators. Yet, at the very instant, the divine decree condemning the Jews, the 40-year sojourn in the wilderness, was announced, Terach immediately revealed his plans to Joshua the Avion, because he thought that the golden opportunity had not been found. And Rashi did not accept Vayikach. Vayikach, Moshach, Roshri, Sanhedrin, Shevohem, Bidvarim. First, he decided himself to fight against Moses, to defeat Moses, to remove him from his historical sphere. Next, he had not courage to reveal the plan to others. Following the incident with the Merachim, his Moshach Roshi Sanhedrin, he addressed the chiefs of the Sanhedrin and the court by fine words, clever words, intelligent words. As all say, Terach Shepitiach was a clever, intelligent man. How did Chazal know about it? Because he made money, so he was a rich man, all right. No, rich man is here. Not only is he a rich man, a clever man, intelligent man. I know many stupid people who are rich, because his arguments, we'll analyze his arguments, are indicative of the inner intelligence. So even the Rosh Sanhedrin, the heads of the court, he computed that righteousness is in his heart. And thus it says, his fine words. He began to conspire. Now the conspiracy began. He began to conspire, to criticize, to attack, and to ridicule Moses. Terach used all the weapons of the arsenal as a fierce and reckless person. He saw in conversation with some, he was serious. In conversation with others, he was humorous, fantastic. In conversation with some, he played the role of the prostitute. In his conversation with others, he was the champion of justice. He was very capable. And he involved, interestingly, the Bnei Reuven. So Rashi says, why Bnei Reuven? Why the tribe of Reuven became involved so easily in the conspiracy? So Rashi says, Elo Rosh HaVeli Shvenu. That's the neighbor of Terach. So he met Terach too often, too many times. нас судят неуправленности. На Рамбану в этом мире жить. Это не Рубен Хедолсе, это ваш агент Моше. Агент Джейко. Вот это не агент Джейко. So the best of the gods to Moses. Because the woman was deprived of the Pharaoh, the Hunner and Levi and the Mount. They also nursed a grudge against Moses. They also felt hurt because Moses took away the Pharaoh from them, the privilege of Moses and the Hunner and Levi. However, any conspiracy or organized movement, in order to succeed, any rebellion, in order to make headway, no matter how egotistically this rebellion is motivated, in order to make headway, to succeed, must develop an ideology. If it's a spontaneous reaction, it's too big a flaw, there is no need to develop a philosophy or to quarrel on behalf of ideas, to represent ideas. But if Korach, I mean, to end the movement, it was a movement. It was a conspiracy. It was an anti-Moses movement. So such a movement cannot exist, cannot succeed without developing the proper ideology. The motto, any movement must have a motto. A motto is indispensable. And Korach indeed did provide the philosophy of the rebellion. Taylor is interested to tell us not only about the facts, the events that transpired, but also about the ideology, which they are formulated, and simply, I believe, the culture is out to tell us the distinction or the difference between the Moses approach and the Torah's approach to serve the Let us concentrate. What would you say? How many arguments did they get out of one? How many arguments? Ideological arguments. In order to justify these attitudes, these standards. How many? What would you say? How many? I believe there was only one argument. It branched out later. It's seven. But I'm going to investigate basically I'm going to investigate two arguments. First, the argument which is there as related to the very beginning of the story. And second, an argument which there has not mentioned at all, but somehow, in a mysterious way, we don't know how Chazal introduced the argument about the Chazal. Let us concentrate first upon the most potent of all arguments that Korach advanced against Moses. Namely, with the argument which Korach stated at the very beginning of the story. Vayikra'u al Moshe v'al Aharon, vayemru aleihem, rab lachem, kicholayid okulam kdoshim, ubesecho v'ashem, lelomot tisnasu al kala v'ashem. You've gone too far, for all the community is holy, all of them are holy, and the Lord is in their midst. Why then do you raise yourselves above the congregation of the Lord? It is a solid argument. Thus, the problem of leadership and exercise of power was raised. Korach thought, apparently, that Moshe seized power illegitimately. He usurped power. That Moses is a usurper. He impugned Moses' authority. He challenged Moses. And the basis of this challenge was very simple. And at first glance, quite rational. No one can deny, and no one can deny, Korach herself has ascertained that the whole community is all. Is it a lie? Is it a lie, Mr. Korach? Or is it a plantation? And that every Jew possesses intrinsic sanctity and inner charismatic quality, elevating the Matabadas. No one can deny it. This is the very essence of Tzilas Yisrael. As far as covenantal choiceness and holiness are concerned, I mean, Tzilas Yisrael, there is no distinction. There was no distinction between Moses and the woodchucker, between Moses and the wood and the water drawer. Not at all. No matter how simple the woodchucker is, and no matter how great in spirit Moshe was. Else, Korach asked, and the question merits an answer. What right did Moses or Aaron have to lead, to guide, to rule? It is the age-old or millennia-old question pertaining to the principle of equality of man versus election and singling out of an individual. Let us analyze this argument. Korach was wrong, I mean, I may say, this is an absolute postulate. Korach was wrong. Because he was unaware of the twofold character of the Kedushas Yisrael. Had he known the mystery of the dual Kedushas idea, he would not have advanced the argument. What is this twofold Kedushas idea? What am I referring to? And here I must introduce a Rashi in Deuteronomy dwelling. The Rashi mentioned once in my Shuva Shurim, but I had arrived in Kakot Rashi quite differently than I wanted to do that. So I'm not plagiarizing myself. Siyam Kodi Shato Ma Dishem Rekecho, a passage in A.A. Ubeho Kofa Radishem, Li Yisrael Le'am Zgula. Rashi adds a few words. Ti'am Kodesh Ato V'dushas Atzmecho Me'adishecho Ve'yit B'cho Pocha Hadishem Li Yisrael Le'am Zgula. Very cryptic, Rashi. Ti'am Kodesh Ato. But the Rashi apparently could not understand why the Torah is duplication in the present. The Torah said, "Come, tell us how to Hashem lekecho." Why does the Torah have to continue and say, "Ubechol kochah Hashem liyisrael amzgula"? Rashi couldn't understand it. So Rashi said, "The Torah has formulated here two ideas of tradition. Tiam kodesh ato, v'dushas atzmecho ma'adishecho, v'yeid mo'ara." Let me just translate to English. Thou art holy. Your holiness comes to you from your fathers. Kedushas Atzmecho Me'adishecho. Believe B'chol Kochah. But in addition to that Kedusha, the Lord has chosen thee to be a cherished people. Unto himself. In other words, Rashi tells the thought that there is a twofold idea to Shas Yisrael. First, the community as a whole is holy, as an entity. Many times in my lectures, I try to simply put across the idea that Knesset Yisrael is not just a herd, not just a crowd, not just a conglomerate of people, not just a multitude of souls, but it is individuality, it's an entity. It is a personality, a living personality. Knesset Yisrael as a whole. First, the community for which you have the most beautiful term, Knesset Yisrael Rambam. Rambam speaks about that term in Tarsus HaYisod. The most beautiful term, Knesset Yisrael, the community as a whole is holy. This kedusha of the community, I mean the covenantal community, is inherited from our ancestors. In other words, there is a genetic code of kedusha. You know what the genetic code is? So we think genetic biological, all these terms have a biological genetic code. Rashi knew of another genetic code of kedusha, which is transmitted most probably to the Jews. Or transmitted to the soul, I don't know. But it means it is a genetic code of kedusha. Otherwise, you cannot speak of inheritance. And that's the reason that if a baby is born to a Jewish mother, the Jew-related baby is considered Jewish. This is the Am Kodesh Akron Ladishalata. The baby is a member of the community. The community bestows the Kedusha over the baby, on the baby. This Kedusha is inherited from our forefathers. The community is consecrated, consecrated as a unitary entity, as a whole. The individual, in order to lay claim to the Kedusha, must draw upon the resources of the Kedusha available to the community. I am holy because I belong to a community. I am united with a community. I am affiliated with a community. And that community happens to be holy. As a whole. So if the whole is holy, if the parts comprising the whole are also endowed with sanctity. The Kedusha, this Kedusha, Kiyam, and it was as Kiyam Kodesh, after Ladishem Malekah. You are holy as a what? As a people, as a nation, as a community. You know what Am means in Hebrew. Am in Hebrew means Im, together. By being together, you are holy. It's not a separate holiness, it's not individual holiness, it's not a personal holiness, it's a together holiness. This Kedusha is not a personal, intimate, but a universal, community rooted, and community nourished and centered. I am holy because I'm a child of a people who inherited Kedusha from its progenitors. In light of this theory, we establish, or this theory establishes, the supremacy of what? Of community over individual. You know, it's no controversy among philosophers. We occasionally meet. Whom should supremacy be assigned? The individual over the community, or the community over the individual? In a very well-done American social philosophy, since the days of Jefferson, has clung stubbornly to the idea that the individual reigns supreme. But however, from the viewpoint of the unpunished actor of Hashem Rekeho, seeing this controversy from the viewpoint of unpunished actor of Hashem Rekeho, we may say that the others did not agree with Jefferson. or the French encyclopedist collapsed us at the age of reason, or the scale, and so on. It has established the supremacy of the community over the individual. The community is primary, is of primary. The individual is of secondary significance. Again, the community is placed above the individual, a person, etc. The unpublished Ato Ladishem Narika. As a matter of fact, Marxism, actually, I mean, really knew that, subscribes to that, to this theory, that the community is above the individual. You are consecrated to me as a people, as a nation, as a community. The individual fiduciary is derived from that of the community. Hence, all fiduciaries are commensurate and active for us. If the individual derives his fiduciary from the community, so Moshe derived as much fiduciary from the community as the woodchopper did. Here justice prevails. Here is an absolute democratic approach to the partition of the share. There is no differentiation of Russians from the viewpoint of the unpublished patrolation. However, the artist was not too happy with that. Not satisfied. Is this social aspect of the ship. Because this aspect, if accepted as the only source of the ship, if the community is the only source of the ship, then the individual would be deprived of his creative role, of his individual initiative, of his originality, and uniqueness. If there is one Kedusha, the only one, rooted in the community, and all individuals receive share for share alike, then the genius cannot be fake. The outstanding person cannot develop into a great money, because there is the partition of dishes are like the share for share alike. And the Torah says that in addition to the community dishes, I'm putting Shatom and Hashem and the couple, there is another resource of dishes. Where is this resource of dishes to be found? In the individual. The individual must discover himself this resource of dishes. The Kedusha which the individual detects in the inner recesses of his personality is already personalistic, single, unique. He has the Kedusha, no one has the Kedusha like his. There is no share. The individual Kedusha cannot be shared with somebody else. It's mine, completely mine. Exclusively mine. I could paraphrase the Mama Chazal, the same ship as the Tayem Shal Meodom, Mishuni Zen is the Tarde Tayem, as the paraphrase and say, the same ship de Tayem Shal Meodom, Mishuni Zen is the rule, Tach the Dushi Tayem. From this viewpoint, the community derives what? The Kedusha from the individual. The Kedusha Shalom is integrated of the countless Kedusha experiences of the individual members of that community. Just the reverse of the previous Kedusha. The single person sanctifies the community. How beautifully did the Torah state I'm holding shelter under the shadow of Jacob. Of course you are holy because you are a member of the holy nation. Because you are a principle or a component part of the great holy community. But at the same time, move ahead. He has the Lord chosen to form a treasure of people. There is a separate duty attached to thee as an individual, as a single person. In the whole Bochar HaDeshem, Lios, Cornelius. The whole is the Torah addresses itself to the individual. Somebody say it in English. In the whole Bochar HaDeshem. And God shall be with the mission. What? Leos, Leos? To form, to create an address of people. Before the people precede the individual. The unfortunate shuttle of December. Now the individual precedes the people. With the hope of our addition. And we have the Lord chosen. To fulfill a mission, namely what mission? Leaders to form or to create or to organize an unschool world. Leaders has the connotation in this context of forming, constituting, or creating an unschool world. It is obvious that as far as the Kirash is living is concerned, there are as far as the election of the individuals is concerned, the endowments cannot be equal. Each individual received an endowment which what? Which is, reflects the greatness of his personality. The individual the individual experiences are incommensurate and completely proportionate to the individual's involvement, dedication, and to the individual's depth and sleep. The Kedusha is an expression of his greatness, and that's all people are alike as far as greatness is concerned. The statement by Korach, the whole aid of human creation is correct as long as we are speaking of the community with exhibition. Inherited from our ancestors. Moses was born in the Jewish community, and the baby of a slave was born in the Jewish community. They received share and share alike. Their shares in the endowment of sanctity were equal. However, when we shift our attention from the social aspect to the individual aspect of Kedusha, the whole idea of equality turns into an absurdity. Here I've said before the aid of Kulon Kedushin, in the Sefer Magishem, he emphasized the term Eidor. The word before the Eidor should be translated as the entirety of the congregation. The whole of the congregation is the source of Kedusha. However, he forgot that there is another aspect of Kedusha, the private, individual one. From that standpoint, from the standpoint of the Yom Kodesh, after Hashem HaKerov, Korach's argument would have been a solid one. Yet under the aspect, so you have to admit that Kedusha's nature is above and beyond the Kedusha of the woodchucker or the whatever. Interesting is nature's answer. What is nature's answer here? Greater the Yeda, the Shem, the Sashalim, the Sakodesh, the Kedusha, the Sashalitha, the it's a cryptic, mysterious answer. Come morning, the Lord will make known who is his and who is holy, and will grant him access to himself. He will grant access to the one he has chosen. Moses speaks not of a congregation. Terach speaks of a congregation. The Chomer is a full congregation. Terach speaks of a congregation. The Chomer is a full congregation. Your whole is holy. The God derives its Kedusha from the whole. Your Kedusha is transmitted by the whole to its component part. Meisha speaks. The Yeda Adishir Meisha Shavei. He speaks about private persons. Moses speaks not of a congregation, but of an individual. Almost the same term says the Torah speaks in a congregation from that viewpoint you are right, but another viewpoint of vision. And as far as Kriya is concerned, individual Kriya, personalistic Kriya is concerned, there is a difference between individual and individual. Interest in Meister's Beitia. Beitia of Yidda Vishem. Come morning, and the Lord will make known. You know very well, but Radak, Ramban, Rid Nelson, Gaon, there's not a single Mephosh which has omitted this explanation. Beitia in Hebrew, according to the medieval grammarians, has the connotation of discriminating, differentiating, leyuchar lebakir, min ben asnura, ben ahuva, ben asnura. Or leyuchar lebakir, bin teid lachara. The differentiating between individual forms. Beitia means the period of recognition. And this is not, I would say, Drush, homiletics. That's the interpretation was advanced by the Radak, by the Ramban, by the Nezrek, by the greatest grammarians of the Middle Ages. Beitia means the period of recognition, identification of things, events, and people. Eretz, in contradistinction, is the time of monarchy. Uniformity. Eretz, we say the Radak, is like Arev, Tzavuvis, mixture, merger, oneness. The time of apprehension, Eretz is the time of apprehending the surroundings as one amorphous formlessness. When all tzuvot, all forms, all individuals merge into one homogeneous blessed reality. In the darkness, what do you see? Just a blessed reality, a blessed something. Korach, Moshe said to him, your concept of Kedusha is identical with the Eretz. It is the bleakness of an autumnal night whose darkness and drearness envelops everything. All you see is one piece of formless reality called Eido. You don't see individuals. Your Kedusha is Eretz. Your concept of Kedusha is limited to what Eretz was used to call to the Hillel, to some amorphous mass. What the medieval philosophers call Chenarai Yuri. To the primordial mixture and leveling off of specific individual traits. Of course, from the viewpoint of Helen, your argument is valid. However, there is another idea of the holy. The personal individualistic holiness, in which the human personality, with all its singular greatness and beauty, participates. This is the holiness of the morning. Danger of the leader. This is the holiness which discriminates. The holiness which sees individuals in each individual in the world of self. It is the holiness which does not look upon the world as a one blessed formlessness. What is it? Colorful. Colorful. The world full of sun, joy, and individual freedom, and individual greatness. This is the holiness of the morning. is when the world emerges from the likely anonymity into the individuated, distinct morphological existence. As far as this holiness is concerned, the proud is far below the individual. Each person is consecrated to a unique task that only he can perform. I believe that it's you. As a matter of fact, variables are popular subjects. Now, with its two basic performances of acts, Miller and Durer symbolically represent the two dimensions of the universal community-rooted concept of vision and the individual concept of vision. The conduct must attain both aspects. The community-rooted social vision as well as the individualistic, personalistic vision. The newer circumcision unites the conqueror with the community. With the people, or nation, through Miller, the girl becomes integrated into the community. Basically, Miller is the sign of identity. What is it? Will you start looking around here? Sit down. Sit down and listen. The Miller unites the girl with the community. With the people or nation. Through Miller, the job becomes integrated into the community. And by so doing, he is given the opportunity to draw upon the communal social resources of Tushé and to be a component part of the community. However, the personal element of the Tushé is still missing. There can be no conversion without actually the acquisition of Duché at both levels. Therefore, Vire was introduced. Vire is indicative of personal commitment. The act of Vire is inseparably linked up to whoever studied the woman's voice. This couple of illnesses, you know very well, when does that they are acceptable illnesses? Vire is Vire. What is Kabbalah's uniqueness? It's not a personal commitment to God. Not through the community, but a personal commitment on the part of the convert. There the convert and God face each other. The convert commits itself. The personal individual election is attainable only after the girl separates himself from the community for a short time, retreats into isolation, hiding in the water, immersion, and accepts responsibility not as a member of the community. That kind of responsibility. Now I want to ask something. It's also important to know. Tirach charged that Moshe and Aaron were power hungry. He personally set up a power structure and raised themselves above the congregation. What always angers me is the arrogant word that here, the moment is nothing, our coalition. It's nothing, you know what in Hebrew is nothing means? To strah, Regel, weil da sind die Jungen, wer hat es, die Schnapsen Riemer, an mir im Meer. Denn die Klingen sind am Hange. Ich sehe es nicht. Klär auch um das Hange. Die Schimpfe ist nicht anders denn, die Verlust der Power und der Leadership. Und die hat es nicht gekonnt. Sie identifiziert die Exercise of Power, with kingship. And the community which is subjected to a power structure we identify as politeia, or as the political community, or as the state, he was wrong. This equation of leader and king and the politicization of the relationship between the leader and those whom he leads. This was the this equation of leader and king and the politicization of the relationship between the leader and those whom he leads. This was the equation of leader and king. And the relationship between the leader and those who are led. And that is, you can equate it as a political relationship. These two equations are one. The covenantal community, and believe me, and this is true, I mean, and every Jew should know that. The covenantal community is first and foremost not a political community. And the Jewish community, I wouldn't allow me to. It is a teaching community. The central figure in the covenantal community throughout the ages and millennia was not the king, never the king, nor the warrior, or high priest, but the teacher, the rabbi. The people are not subjects, as it is customary in the political community. The people in the governmental community are disciples. The relationship is not of a political nature. It is not rooted in violence, because any political community must use violence. The generic political community cannot exist without the use of violence. Nor is it connected with the application of sanctions. It is a free commitment on the part of the disciples to their master and teacher. The latter did not impose any authority upon the disciples. No one asked them to obey his words and to follow him. They can terminate this relationship at any time, the disciple. You cannot terminate, it's very hard to terminate a political relationship. You know, we're talking in America during the Civil War, when the states, when the southern states wanted to terminate a political relationship. Judaism has disapproved, basically, of all forms of human government. There are definite streaks, but I want you not to misunderstand me. There are definite streaks of political anarchism in our reluctance to recognize man as king. Man, at best, is a melech hayim. And one of the topics of Rosh Hashanah is to contrast Melech Elyon and Melech Adin. And by so contrasting, we condemn Melech Adin. Melech Adin is a bluffer, nothing else. A daydreamer. Because there is no Melech Adin. Because Melech Adin is a contradictory in adjecto. God governs. Nobody else must usurp
this pyramid. The only power structure that the halacha of Judaism has accepted is the non-institutionalized relationship prevailing between teacher and pupil within the teaching covenantal community. Moshe is not known to us as king, even though he was king, by Yiddish Yirom Elach. He is known as Rebbe, Moshe Rabbein. He is known to us as the greatest of all teachers, as the teacher par excellence, the father of all prophets, even though he was also king, warrior, etc. Aaron is not just the high priest. He is the great teacher. He seeks the Kingish Mordas, the Tero Yavak Shumpian. The priests themselves are not just charismatic personalities. Their sanctity is associated with the teaching they engaged. The disciples love their master and listen not to his orders, since he gives none, but to his teachings, which enlighten their minds and gladden their hearts. Moses did not raise himself above the community, as Korach stated and Korach thought, but he was raised by the community above itself. It was raised by the congregation to their exalted heights at a spiritual, not political level. And as a matter of fact, spiritual malchut is by far more powerful and more enduring than political malchut. The reflexiforum, the lomotis nasco, is out of context to what's wrong. Moses was elevated without questing for leadership. He was not a misnase, but a person, or a misson. The leader who is the great teacher is the holy man. The teacher is simply elected by God to be near him, and his personal Dusha transcends that of his disciples. The Dusha of his equation, the Dusha teaching. The saintly person is the leader at the same time, because he is the teacher. Now let us pick up this second argument of God. The second argument of Korach has not been mentioned in the Bible. Rashi quotes from Talmud and tells us the following humorous story. Omar Pekinis Reish Nun Rosh Sanhedrius, the Bishop Tarlistis Shekulon Treves, Bob Rondulis Nomeshe, Bob Rulei Talis Shekulon Treves, Hayedis Bifiti Sektura, Amalayam Treves, ישחילו לישחי קולות, איך שהטלי של מנחר, חותכות של חרס פטרו, זו שכולות חרס, ודיסטרס עצמו, היא עתיר תירח 250 צ'יפס על דקורות על צהרו, עם רואו קצף חרס, פרפו, לא, אין אני אומר, פרפו וולד, ביטרפו. Then they came and stood before Moses and said to him, is a garment that is entirely of purple, subject to the law of Titus, or is it exempt? It is subject to the law, as of Moshe. Moshe was a lump. He said, that's me, I would also say, subject. Whereupon they began to jeer at him. Is it possible? Is this possible? They asked. A robe of any different colored material, one thread of purple. If you attach one thread of purple, it is exempted from the obligation of tzitzis. And the robe that is entirely of purple should not be exempted. The Midrash tells us another story, which is similar to that of Cyrus. Namely, they ask Moshe a second question. Should one attach a mezuzah to the doorpost of a house filled with scrolls, the Sifrei Torah? Moses answered in the affirmative, of course. They jeered again. And said, is it possible the two short sections, Shema Elohim Shomea, are enough in order to exempt the house from the obligation of mezuzah, while a multitude of Sifrei Torah does not exempt the house from Sifrei Torah? What is the Midrash out to tell us about these two stories? The stories are similar, they're almost like The motif is identical. And what did the Midrash have to tell us? So tell us the Midrash felt with these two stories. First, which had a bunch of sarcasm and humor as well. We will reflect the whole philosophy of Kera Chumadiwa. You see, as I told you, Kera developed an ideology. He had a substitute for Kera's mission. He wanted to achieve something, because he wanted to take over. But the Midrash wants to bring out, by relating to us, is sarcastically, in good humor, these two stories, is I believe is of us. And I would ask people to give me attention, because it's not important. Important as far as our times are concerned. Terach rebelled against authority. All Jews are equal. Hence, everyone is entitled to interpret the law. It's a question of interpretation of the law. You see, that's why the Midrash introduced the story about the Chelas, about the Mezuzah, that Terach not only wanted political power, he wanted to remove Moshe from office and succeed Moshe as king. No! He wanted to succeed Moshe as rabbi. That generations, countless generations afterward, should say Kerach Rabbein. That was his ambition. Yeah, don't know. That was his ambition. So hence, he not only impugned and challenged Moses' authority as king, political authority, but he challenged his halachic authority. Can Moshe interpret the law? Is Moshe Alam? The study of the law, to Korach, and to show to the people, to the 250 scholars, the chief justices, that Moshe is incapable of interpreting the law. So he posed to Moshe those two questions. Moshe answered in the affirmative, while the 250 scholars, I don't know, I wouldn't have given them a snippet, but the 250 scholars have decided that Moshe is wrong. Not only Moshe is wrong, they feared him, they laughed at him. It was to them nonsense, absurd. The study of the law, apparently, Kerach argued. The study of the law and its interpretation, Terach argued, are exoteric acts, democratic acts, in which every intelligent person may engage. Moses' claim to being the exclusive legal authority and exclusive interpreter of the law, Terach argues, Uber are unfounded and unblind. The consequence of such a democratic philosophy is obvious. What Kirchhoff wanted, and what many want even now, and I'm not speaking only about dissident groups, but I'm speaking about the Orthodox community. What Kirchhoff wanted, and what many dissident groups want now, whether they state it clearly or they use equitable terms and dubious language to cover it up, is that the instrument of interpretation of the Torah be common sense. Or the everyday empirical intelligence, not the esoteric conceptualizing logos, which can only be attained through painstaking study and hard training. In Hebrew, we have three terms which signify the human intellectual gesture. You all know Chokhmah bin Adas. I'm not going to analyze those three terms, but I want to show you just one distinction. Das denotes, particularly in Talmudic language, common sense. Not wisdom, common sense. Sound, practical judgment. We come across the expressions Ben Das, Ben Das mean? An average intelligent person, not an idiot. Although Nitro for Taipei, let me Nitro for Taipei mean? He was his reason, I mean, reasonableness. You're correct. A person deprived of Das is an idiot, senseless, foolish. In contradistinction to Das, Chokhmah bina. Refer to scholarship, to specialized knowledge, to a trained logos, to an intellect which was subjected to training and criticism for a long time, to the precise, exact intellect. The Korach group pleaded the case of common sense for Das. They argued that every Jew with common sense should have the right to interpret the laws of the Torah and determine halachic matters in categories of in common sense categories. There are different categories, guys. As a matter of fact, right here, the ritual committees in the non-Orthodox synagogues, or perhaps even in Orthodox synagogues, employ common sense in reaching the halachic decisions. In fact, all the foreign movements, from the Tzedukim during the Second Temple down to religious liberalism of today, pleaded the cause of common sense as the instrument of interpretation. I'll give you an example. The Tzedukim of old said, the Mishnah Yedayim tells us, that the daughter inherits the estate of the father if the son died and left only a daughter. If there is a problem, if there is litigation between the daughter of the father and the granddaughter of the father, then the daughter of the father should get his head. You know what the Prussian said. Prussian said that if there is litigation between the daughter of the father, of the deceased father, and the granddaughter, who gets his head? The granddaughter. The Prussian kept on arguing that it will be unjust to discriminate against the legitimate rights of the daughter of the deceased. If the heir on the opposite side, its opposite number, is also a daughter, but not the daughter of the father, but got her as his son. And why should the real daughter surrender the estate to a granddaughter who is not closer, who is not as closely related to the father as she is? What do you say about it? From the viewpoint of common sense, of the exoteric empirical intelligence, it took him away. Right? Well, Mitchell, tell the other sense. How? In fact, under the aspect of common sense, or the very practical approach, Kirach's argument against Moshe's decision was also valid. If one purple thread is sufficient, why should the purple garment require stitches? If one can fulfill mitzvah's mezuzah by attaching two parashiyot to the door, why should not the presence of many souls in the house exempt the latter from the need of a mitzvah? However, and this is basically now a trend in the Jewish communities, in Orthodox communities, to introduce common sense as an instrument of interpretation. I know what I'm talking about. Some of you are, I believe it. You understand me. However, Torah Shabbat Peh cannot be identified with common sense, with das, with this form. It has a methodology of its own. It has a singular approach. It has a distinct form of analysis. It has its own categories and its own strange schemata. Fundamentally, the Torah Shabbat Peh avails itself of a method of conceptualization. Whoever knows what Torah Shabbat Peh is and the method of teaching Torah Shabbat Peh, particularly the method which was forged by Rabbi Kleger, for some say that Kleger says the series of Chaim Rizka. Chaim Rizka actually developed this method to teaching height is longest, basically. What do you call longest? Consists in the ability to conceptualize. Will you conceptualize Sukkot? Will you conceptualize Bus of the Holland? Will you conceptualize Tahumis? Will you conceptualize the whole Torah? The Halacha works like the mathematician in an a priori world. Its constructs are ideal. Torah Shabbat Peh does not study reality. It prepares abstract schemata and applies them to the world of science. And I'll give you an example. In fact, Aristotle and the entire Greek science, which unfortunately dominated the Western world throughout the antiquity and the Middle Ages, failed miserably in Aristotelian physics. I don't say Aristotelian philosophy, Aristotelian logic, but Aristotelian physics failed miserably. You know why? Because its foundation was common sense. The empirical human intelligence, which operates usually with platitudes and commonplace ideas. The great accomplishment of Galileo and Newton consisted in replacing the practical common sense approach with a conceptualizing, creative logos. With that, we all call now the scientific logos. What is scientific logos? What's the difference between scientific logos and the lay logos? Of course, the scientific logos is trained. The lay logos is not trained. Scientific logos is precise. The lay logos is not precise. But what is the main difference? The main difference is scientific logos conceptualizes reality, while the lay logos, or the common sense logos, takes reality at face value. They proclaimed the principle, Galileo knew, of mathematization and quantification of the order, of converting sense qualities like heat, like light, like color, like sound, into quantitative relations, mathematical relations. Now, here's an example. Aristotle, for instance, said, all things fall downward because they are heavy. You see, in other words, he considered the gravitational pull as the result of heaviness or weight. This is nonsense. The reverse is true. Weight is the consequence of the gravitational pull. Newton discarded common sense and approached the matter from the viewpoint of the esoteric, abstract, creative, conceptualizing lovers, and came up with his famous formula that gravitation equals the product of both masses over the square of the distance, mm over d, doing second potency. In other words, gravitational pull is nothing but a mathematical relation between two bodies, which consists of the product of the masses over the square of the distance. This method of quantification was perhaps the greatest discovery in the annals of mankind. Of course, if we had been satisfied, not we, but in the 17th century, had been satisfied with Einstein physics, we couldn't climb out to the moon. Don't you think that Allah is also entitled to such a prerogative? We have, as I stated above, our unique logical and epistemological approach to Allah. Basically, Torah Shebaalpeh is not just a compilation of laws. It is a compilation of laws. But it's more than that. Mathematics is not just a corpus of equations. Ask any mathematician who is intelligent how to do it. What is math? It didn't tell you it's a corpus of equations. Or no physicist. Well, who understands physics? No physicist will tell you that physics is a collection of natural laws or equations. Basically, science is a method. Mathematics is a method. Physics is a method. It's a method of thinking. A unique logos. So is the Torah Shebaalpeh. The laws and statutes are of utmost significance. However, if you discard the view that Torah Shebaalpeh is a system of thought structure and logical categories, unique logical categories, which are accessible to the mind, to the human mind, only the latter is ready to subject itself to a rigid and dark training, then you unlock the floodgate, and any ignoramus may claim authority the way Korah did. I'll give you an example, for instance. You know now the movement of the women elite, right? And the complaint against Torah Shebaalpeh, against our Allah. Allah has discriminated against the women. The woman is not an equal of men in Allah. That's what I hear. And then the rabbis are ready to surrender. Right. In order to clear the few ladies of the women elite. Basically, whoever studied Chumash knows Chumash well. Whoever studied the Gemara knows the discharge is sheer libel. Since the Chumash embraces says that God created men, Zohar and Kippur boys, Bitzalim and Akim boys, that men and women were created in the image of God, equality is taken for granted. Two creatures, two personas, are created in the image of God. You cannot say one is superior to God. So people come out always and say, why is one personas disqualified to bear witness? This qualification to bear witness is completely, if you speak in terms of Torah, Afghanistan, pro-Aristotelian terms, Afghanistan. It's a good argument. Since at the wedding, I'll look first for another witness. You see, I'm one witness for some of it. And I'll look many a time. I'll look for another witness. And that's when I don't find it. My daughter, I can't find another witness who is a Shema Mitzvah. And I don't invite a woman to witness the ceremony, sanction the ceremony. Apparently she's inferior to the man. It is not for her. If the Melech HaMashiach was not present at the wedding, I wouldn't invite him either, because he's also disqualified to bear witness. So will you say that all Jews are superior to the Melech HaMashiach? King Messiah, king, is disqualified to bear witness, like a Isha. Because, will you say that the King Messiah, or King David, or King Solomon, or Moshe Rabbeinu himself, were disqualified to bear witness? A Melech is postulated, I can't help it. Would you derive a mean conclusion from it? That David is the Moses. And a wood chapel, an ignorant person, not poor mineralized, is special. If observed, the mitzvah. Will you say that the psulatus can be translated into axiological terms? And the conclusion with the Vorenza can justify to say that the King Messiah, the Melech HaMashiach, is inferior to some ignorant Jew? If you operate with common sense categories, yes. Kerach operated with common sense categories, then he was right in his conclusion that Atalus Chedot is the whole world is made of purple material. Circle should be exempt from the nearest. But from the viewpoint of the exact, precise, the unique halakhic categories. From the viewpoint of such halakhic structure, is Eidos has is not indicative at all of the station of the woman in society, in the halakhic community. The same is true about the minyan. We don't count the woman. Does it mean that the woman is inferior? It's very strange, I said it in my yard, that the greatest teacher of all pertaining to prayer was a woman. The Mora says it's not for Chaneh, or you wouldn't be able to pray. So Chaneh was the greatest of all teachers pertaining to prayer. But Chaneh herself couldn't have joined the meal. Does it mean that Chaneh was inferior to some ignorant person? Who was counted among the ten? Not at all. In categories, in common sense categories, yes. But in strict halachic categories, in the strict original halachic categories, is the first woman cannot be counted as the tenth person, tenth or the ninth, as a member of the congregation. There's absolutely nothing in common with the axiological problem of equality of men. The trouble now is that many people seems to be alumnus very hard. You have to work very hard on it. So many people are ready to exchange alumnus for common sense categories. Now let me explain. The adherents of the common sense halacha, no matter what they call it, they call it meaningful halacha, creative halacha, new halacha, quite a variety of terms. I'm never impressed by terms in cliches. But actually what they want is common sense halacha. Our misled by a basic philosophical doctrine containing half-truths and platitudes. be expound since the days of Kerach. More or less, a theory of religious subjectivism. Prima facie, it is hard to refute this theory. It was, as I told you, it was hard to refute Korach's argument of Kecholayid Apolomish. Because both arguments contain each other of truth. They say, and you have heard that, probably you heard it quite often, Rachmon el Libedoy, God is interested in the heart. In man's inner world, faith, fundamentally, is an inner experience. Man, they say, needs God in the mysterious recesses of his personality. The God experience is iridescent, dynamic, bold, and breaks through the exterior of the human personality and turns into objective deeds, into action. In words, they claim, and this is the theory, philosophy of religious subjectivism, which is so popular now in the United States, it's known under the name and the trademark of existentialism, religious existentialism. In words, they say, the mitzvot manifest an inner mood, a spiritual presence, a hidden feeling of happiness or sadness. The mitzvot are supposed to reflect the inner experience. The mitzvot upon them are external correlates which run parallel to the experiential order. Each experience has its external correlate in the form of action. If this theory, they argue, is correct, then the mitzvot have got to correspond to the mood which they are supposed to express in the most competent way. Hence, the mitzvot must avail themselves of the media of expression which are best fitted to reflect the inner experience. And they argue, the scholars live in a world of abstractions, cannot determine the redemptive power of mitzvot. Only a common sense approach is capable of gauging the therapeutic energy of each mitzvah and to utilize it in the most efficient manner. Korach said to Moses, the glue thread was meant as a reminder to make us think of something of distance, infinity, of the mysterious link between the blue sea and the blue sky. Why is it necessary to limit this symbolism to a thread and not extend it to the whole garment? From the standpoint again of common sense, Halacha, Kirach was right. A beautiful, colorful robe may have a greater impact upon the individual than a single thread. I agree with the preamble of this theory, only the preamble of this theory, that there are two parallel religious orders in Judaism, the objective and the subjective. Judaism, in my opinion, consists of two things, divine disciplines, call it Shogunov, or any other name, and the great romance between finitude and infinity, between God and man. We have a score in our Tanakh, in our Kenneth. It's built exclusively, this great romance, human insertion. Both hidden experience are inseparably united. The deed without experience is an incomplete act, an imperfect gesture, no doubt about it. As a matter of fact, whatever I say in this context is correct from the viewpoint of strict halachic thinking. The question is, it's very easy to say that Judaism consists of a double order. So there is an external order of action, of deeds, or divine disciplines, and an inner experience, or an inner feeling of love for God. The question is, you have to prove it. Is Allah cognizant of experiential moment? And the problem is, you cannot just say, because I like it, or because it's a writer, or people will come to listen to me. How can you prove it that Allah is interested in experience? Exactly. Because certain rituals consist in experience. And I am not referring to the mitzvah of love of God or the mitzvah of love of man. I am referring to ritual mitzvahs. For instance, take Krishna. Krishna, even though it is strictly identified with the recital of a certain fixed and standardized text. However, the Kiva mitzvah is skin belief, is an experience. The same is true of spirit, a radio show. The same most probably is true of Avelis. The same is true of Simchas Yontif. Notwithstanding the halachic requirement for the recital of standardized texts or the observance of external rites, the mitzvahs are consummated, like Avelis, Krishna, Tfilah, and realized in an experience. In other words, even the formal abstract halacha knows of the experience as an important part of the religious gesture. However, and here we reach the boundary. The religious experience is not the primary gesture. It is the secondary. The point of departure must never be the inner subjective experience. No matter how redemptive it is, no matter how colorful it is, no matter how therapeutic it is, no matter how great the impact the experience has upon the total personality of man, it should never be the point of departure. The point of departure must always be the objective external act. The objective act does not symbolically express or interpret the experience. Here they made a mistake. The reverse is true. The experience interprets the act. There are a variety of reasons justifying our thesis concerning the supremacy of the act over the feeling. The supremacy of the solid religious reality or other the emotion. First reason is the religious emotion is changeable, volatile, and transient, like another emotion. Second, each individual experiences God, man, and the world at the religious level in a unique fashion. If the religious act would have to adjust itself to the inner feelings of man, we would have to invent a constantly changing ritual. What the appropriate medium is today will be absolute, or the appropriate medium of expression is today will be obsolete tomorrow. What is good for me does not behoove my next door neighbor. There would be, if the religious experience were the point of departure, and the act and the religious act would have to correspond to the experience, there would be a variety of symbolic actions. We could not speak of a monistic service of God. This kind of ever-changing worship is idolatrous. Interesting is the Rashi in Kirach. Omar Mishra in Kirach.
is the Jehovim Yeshrem Elohu Sabe. The pagans have many gods. Kiyanin Harve, many priests. Rabbi is Harve, in many forms of worship. Onu, Yeshuanu, Kirachot, with one god. Kiyanachot, with one high priest. Rabbi Lachas, with one form of worship. Monistic worship is constant. And monistic worship is not exposed to the winds of change. There is another reason, the reason for giving priority to the act over the experience. It is simply impossible to determine what is what and who is who. We can never determine what is a religious experience in contradistinction to a hedonic, mundane experience. We know of many non-religious emotions, hedonic emotions, which are provided with enormous power. They are hypnotic and at first glance redemptive. One may easily confuse the religious drive with the love impulse. It is quite normal to replace the religious ecstatic craving with the aesthetic yearning of the artist. There are common characteristics in both of them. The quest for exaltedness and infinity is typical of both, of the experience of beauty and the religious experience. To substitute secular for religious emotions is again an idolatrous method. The pagans of old used to indulge in hypnotic orgiastic ceremonials and mistakenly identifying them with the religious experience. The Torah prohibited idolatrous practices to be introduced in the ritual and service of God. Echo Yavdu Akeim Oile Samayim. Therefore, King Amoni, Leisat the King of Shemayim. How did these nations serve the God? Even so will I do likewise. Thou shalt not do so unto the Lord, my God. The Torah had exactly in mind the idolatrous, uninhibited, frenzied, hedonic experiences which the pagans engaged in, confusing them with the religious experience. The rousing of religious awareness by confronting it with the powerful hypnosis of the aesthetic experience, such as music, plastic art, architecture, is alien to Allah and Judaism. For instance, take the organ as an instrument. What's the purpose of the organ? What's the purpose of the organ? There is the pad organ, itself the purpose. What's the purpose of the organ? Prepare a mood. The organ does not prepare a religious mood, because the organ itself is an instrument not of religious experience, but of the artistic experience. So use an artistic experience in order somehow to pave the way for religious mood. The religious mood will never come. The way will be paid by an aesthetic experience. The same is true if you dance. Their dance may rouse. May rouse a person. Of course. Yes, it's stimulating. The rhythm itself is intoxicating. But that's all. The rhythm of dancing is a secular experience. It's not a religious experience. It's an aesthetic experience. You expect that the aesthetic experience will pave the way for a religious experience which will follow the aesthetic experience. That will never happen. Will never happen. Particularly, and that is basically idolatrous. And in my opinion, that is the real reason for the elimination of the organ from the service. Or the non-introduction of the organ into the service.
You have this wonder, and I'll tell you so what, the religious experience, be born in the world of God, not stimulated or governed by a secular, mundane, atomic experience. And of course, and if we use as a stimulate the love experience, then it becomes a barrier. Yes, this is idolatry par excellence. The religious experience is born within the religious awareness, not under the pressure of physiological carnal drives, not even provoked by spiritual needs of the human personality, such as the need for beauty. The same purpose served the architecture of the cathedrals in the Middle Ages, in particular the Gothic architecture. Whoever is acquainted with Spengler's book, The Decline of the Adult of the Best of War of the West, how he interprets in his writing there, the Gothic experience, the Gothic cathedral, wanted to arouse in the human personality, the experience of infinity, of boundlessness, of questing, up into the heavens. Of course, perhaps it may actually provoke such an experience, produce such a quest. But it is an artistic quest, not a religious quest. And to substitute an artistic quest for a religious quest is idolatrous. You know very well, never mind it. Now people speak about architecture at synagogue. There was no architecture at synagogue. We never talked about it. The Jewish synagogue was a plain home. We never tried to influence the Jew by bringing meaning to surroundings, suggesting a transcendental order or other worldliness. We never tried to do it. Catholics, yes. The whole mass, the music, the architecture, are geared to that purpose, to stimulate the person and the aesthetic experience, hoping that by this stimulation, the worshipper will also be aroused to a religious experience. And this is correct. This is absolutely wrong. The religious experience is autonomous, free and original, moves at its own tempo, within its own unique orbit. This kind of independent experience follows, you know when? Follows the deed instead of preceding it. To pray, the next prayer, to engage in a dance or in a song, it's okay. However, to dance in order to pray is futile, because one will never pray. Yahadus expected the religious experience to follow the religious act. The great one else follows the divine discipline, not the reverse. Misha says, if one fulfills mitzvah sitzes, then a glance at the thread, at the purple thread, will produce in him perhaps the experience of infinity. If you proceed from action to experience, then the purple color will remind you of the mystery of existence and our link with God. However, if one fails to conform to the halachic norm and contrary to the rules of halacha, avails himself of a common sense approach, the looking or the glancing at the traders will not produce any reaction. And if a response will be forthcoming, it will be a mundane, hedonic response, not a religious response. It will not inherit my religious experience. Blue, experience of blue, if it follows the Kiyum HaMitzvah, is a great experience. But the experience that you do without the Kila Mitzvah can produce in a vulgar association, vulgar memories, unredeemed experiences. When I hear people talk about meaningful halacha, the unfreezing of the halacha, empirical halacha, I know what the people have in mind, by all the jargon. They have in mind exactly what Kerach and his adherents had when they approached Moses with the problem of Talish Kilatredon. They wanted a common sense interpretive approach to halacha. They simply had no patience to study, to get the proper training, and to master the unique halachic methodology and logic. They rebelled against the institution of wonders. They want to do to halacha what Aristotle did to physics, to convert it into a shallow discipline, replete with platitudes and commonplace ordinary opinions. Of course, Moshe won. The Kira group finally admitted that Moshe and Esmet of Asermet will still study the halacha in light of Moshe's esoteric conceptualizing logic. The Masorah of method of halachic structure and a priori construct will continue forever. Yikti Holov, Kira Samim, Babaker, Bekiri Saneris, Yaktereno, Uba Alei Sarin Saneris, Ben Rabon Yaktereno. And Aaron shall burn the run incense. Every morning he dresses the candles, he shall burn it. And when Aaron lights the candles, the lamps, the dusk, he shall burn it. The burning of the incense and the lighting of the lamps has been emerged by the Torah in one mitzvah. In order to have a satisfaction, in a scotchman well knows that there is a separate view of combining that locus on the earth with that Torah's appearance. There is a separate view of lighting the candles almost simultaneously with the burning of the Torah. What does that locus on the earth signify? It signifies light, understanding, knowledge of the Torah, clarity of concept and the depth of halachic analysis, the clear deed, the intelligent performance. What does Teresa represent? The hidden and the intimate, the mysterium magnum of creation and the mysterium tremendum of divine presence in creation and beyond. The Chisra Anana Teresa has appeared and the cloud of incense may cover the earth. Ptiras tells us the great story of human craving for God, his questing and yearning for the origin. For the makor, for the beginning of all, Ptiras, the symbol, tells us a marvelous story of human tragic waiting for an ecstatic unity with the Almighty. The colorful religious experience is represented by experience. The clear, intelligent religious thought and intelligent action is represented by the candles of the menorah. The Torah, however, admonished us that the burning of the incense be coordinated with the lighting, the mystery of feeling with the clarity of thinking and acting, the excitement and passion of praying be united with the serenity and peace of halachic comprehension and halachic implementation. Both are necessary, yet there is a parallel order of experience and faith, of romance and discipline, of thought and feeling, necessary, yet fears cannot be separated from a block of science. This objective must never be isolated from the objective.
denn die Orisa Meister ist Harten, der Nati Zerat, von der Zürcherz. Die Allah ist Gipfel, und Allah ist Präzision, ist Nefestachin. Ich wohne mir ins Plakein, und es dreht alle Fuhren, und es ist Nefestachin.